Welcome to another edition of the Hitman Chronicles. This is your host, the original great Rob Silver. And damn, I had to fight sleep, and I think I snoozed off a couple of times for about 30 to 45 seconds for that last fight. God, that was a god-awful fight. Today, we will talk about the three fights that occurred in Corpus Christi, Texas, that was aired on ESPN featuring Robeson Canseco, and the heavyweight doubleheader, Efe Ajagba versus Guido Vianello, and Jared Big Baby Anderson against Ryan Murray. Another Ask Rob Silver Q&A session. And the main event of today's podcast are not the fights that we just saw that aired on ESPN, but I will give you, as part of the main event, historical overview of today's podcast. You see the cover art. We will look at the football career, the college career, the early life of Orenthel James Simpson, O.J. Simpson, who died a few days ago at the age of 76. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll go into full detail about why I chose to discuss that part of O.J. Simpson's career. I'll go into it all on the final segment of the podcast. First and foremost, let's get to the horrific fight card that we saw tonight on ESPN from Corpus Christi, Texas. Can somebody shut Joe Tessitore and Tim Bradley up? They don't know what they're talking about. They're horrible. And Joe Tessitore, will you stop saying that George Kambosos was once the undisputed lightweight champion of the world? No, he wasn't. He held three of the four titles. He was the WBO, IBF, and WBA champion. Devin Haney was the WBC champion. And when they faced off, Haney beat Kambosos to become the undisputed lightweight champion of the world. ESPN, Joe Tessitore, Tim Bradley, Mark Kriegel, all these clowns have to stop giving boxing fans and the viewers of their fights misinformation. Stop lying to the people. One thing we try and give you here on the Hitman Chronicles are facts that are verifiable and the truth. And nothing but the truth. And I will out those that are horrible, that try to ruin the sport of boxing with their misinformation, with their misreporting. ESPN continues to do this over and over again with their hideous boxing coverage when it comes to the announcing team of Tim Bradley, Joe Tessitore, and we didn't have Mark Kriegel tonight, so that was a positive. That's always a positive when that idiot is not on a announcing team. But enough said about these buffoons. Let's get to the fights. The first fight, Robeson Canseco with a one-sided beating of an overmatched fighter from Mexico who had never fought in the United States before, Jose Guardado. It was a one-sided beating by Canseco. Canseco stopped him in the seventh round. Beautiful left to the body. Sort of like a hybrid of a left hook, left uppercut to the body that dropped Guardado. Guardado got up at the count of 9 9/10. And then Canseco jumped on him again, banged that body, and Robeson knocks him out in the seventh round. It was a stay-busy fight for Robeson. He was supposed to win. But I don't know if Robeson's ever going to be a world champion at 130. I would love to see him in a rematch with Oscar Valdez. I think that's his best chance. I don't think he could beat the Oshaki Forsters of the world or the Lamont Roaches of the world, but I think he can defeat Oscar Valdez. I thought he won the first fight. I would love to see a rematch, and that's a fight easily made by ESPN. Canseco will have problems with sharpshooters, with good counterpunches, excellent counterpunches like Oshaki Forster or Lamont Roach, because he throws wide punches. you could step in between the punches and counter him, like Shakur Stevenson did all night in their fight. That being said, he's always going to be a live underdog. Doesn't have a lot of power. I mean, he beat up an overmatched fighter before knocking him out with those body shots. Let's see what happens. I gave Canseco all the props in the world for his heartfelt and just warrior-like fight against Emmanuel Navarrete. He got up off the canvas twice to get a 12-round draw in a fight that he came on strong at the end, and he won the last round on all three scorecards to get that draw. And because of his performance against Navarrete, I named him the fighter of the week that week. He did what he was supposed to do tonight. Let's hope he gets another title shot. He earns it. He's the number two contender in one of the Alphabet Soup criminal cartels, and he's the number five contender, I believe, in another one of the criminal soup cartels. So let's see what happens, criminal cartels. Let's see what happens if he can get that, what would it be, a fourth world title shot? And deservedly so, he deserves it. He deserves it. I hope Oshaki Foster, Oscar Valdez, Lamont Roach, one of these guys, battle him for one of these Alphabet Soup criminal cartel world titles. Okay, on to the semifinal. Effie Ajagba against Guido Vianello. Once again, this triple header was held on ESPN live from Corpus Christi, Texas. Vianello came out strong. He easily won the first round. Staggered Ajagba with a beautiful right cross in the second round. Ajagba almost went down, had to hold on. But beginning with the third round, Ajagba, with that beautiful left jab of his, that jab gets better with each fight, began to control the action and landed some devastating right crosses in the third round. And then beginning with the fourth round, he began to land that uppercut over and over again. I gave Ajagba rounds 3-9. He staggered Vianello several times between rounds 4 and 9 with uppercuts. He would switch back and forth. Now here comes Timothy Bradley talking out the side of his ass. In the ninth round, Ajagba was landing that right jab, and he was landing spectacular uppercuts inside. And towards the end of the round, Timothy Bradley was like, I'm not sure who's winning this round. You dumbass. What? Anyway, Vianello had a strong 10th round. You could tell he was fighting out of desperation. So I gave Vianello rounds 1, 2, and 10. I gave Ajagba all the rounds between 3 and 9. My final scorecard was 97-93 Ajagba. Ajagba won by split decision. Two judges gave it to Ajagba. Effie Ajagba, 96-94. The other judge gave it to Vianello, 96-94. Split decision win by Effie Ajagba, who, off the strength of that split decision, is the Hitman Chronicles Fighter of the Week. I want to see Effie Ajagba fight the guy that I'm about to speak about next. I'm sick and tired of Bob Arum, Top Rank, ESPN, putting Jared Anderson in with bum after bum after bum. Jared Anderson is 6'4". Tonight he fought a 5'9" former cruiserweight paper champion in Ryan Murray. Murray had no business in the ring with Jared Anderson. 5'9", bloated. He looks like he's injected with steroids. All he did in this fight was try and survive, and that's what he did. He went 10 rounds, and Anderson boxed carefully. Didn't take any chances against an overmatched opponent. A boring, one-sided 10-round win by Anderson against a guy who had no business being in the ring with Anderson. 7 inches taller Anderson was than Murray tonight. That's ridiculous. There should be no heavyweight at 5'9" fighting today in a significant fight. Not today. Not today. No. There hasn't been a heavyweight champion that short in forever. It will not happen. Bob Arum has got to stop putting Jared Anderson in with bum after bum after bum. And then to hear what Timothy Bradley said today, according to Timothy Bradley, Bob Arum doesn't plan on having Anderson fight a world championship until 2026. Well, so he's going to fight three times this year, three times next year, and then get a shot in 2026? All right, so let's say that's the plan. Why not put him in with the Frank Sanchez's and Effie Ajagbas of the world? Hell, see if you can put him in the ring with a fading Joe Joyce. Let's stop putting him in the ring with guys that have no shot in the world. Effie Ajagba would force Jared Anderson to fight. Ajagba with that left jab would force Anderson to fight. We need that fight. We need Big Baby to stop with the fights still being strapped into a car with a car seat. No. With a baby, the baby car seats, whatever you call them shits. We got to take the training wheels off of Big Baby Anderson. You're not going to learn anything by fighting stiffs like the guy he fought tonight. Anderson learned nothing. He fought a human punching bag. Let's stop with the nonsense, please. All right. Now, real quick, my prediction on tonight's next Saturday's night's fight at the Barclays Center, which has done horrible business. I see they gave away a bunch of tickets. They gave away like 3,000 tickets this week at the Barclays Center. It's pathetic. Devin Haney defending his criminal cartel alphabet soup WBC super lightweight championship against Ryan Garcia. I got Devin Haney winning a wide 12-round decision against Ryan Garcia. Now, Ryan Garcia is going to try, but Ryan Garcia is going to maybe come off to a fast start, maybe even win a couple of rounds within the first six rounds, but Haney, I see, sweeping the latter part of the fight and winning a lopsided decision, 118-110, 117-111, along that. And it'll be another victory in the record for Devin Haney. And then Ryan Garcia is going to have to sit back and think long and hard about his career after losing this fight, because there's a lot of natural ability with Ryan Garcia, but I don't think he has ever been or will ever be on the professional level an elite fighter. That's just my opinion. Ryan, prove me wrong. And now on to the Ask Rob Silver portion of the podcast. For those who want their questions answered on the podcast, go to Twitter, hashtag Ask Rob Silver. It could be any type of question, as long as it's not buffoonery, as long as it's not bullshit. All right. First question. From my man, Half Pint, frequent contributor here on the Hitman Chronicles. He asked, I know Muhammad Ali had more nicknames than Babe Ruth, but was one of the people's champ? And what do you think about the story about Rocky asking Ali about using that title? Is there a hint of truth, or is it all Hogan-style lies? All right. Muhammad Ali became the people's champ. That was one of his nicknames, Half Pint. For those who are listening, including Half Pint, I have a 10-part series here on this podcast series, here on Hitman Chronicles, The Life and Times of Muhammad Ali, and I chronicle his fight that led him to becoming the people's champ after that fight, and that is the biggest fight in the history of boxing and the biggest sporting event in the history of mankind. His March 8th, 1971 Madison Square Garden fight against Joe Frazier. You had the real heavyweight champion of the world, Muhammad Ali, go up against the recognized heavyweight champion of the world by the sanctioning bodies in Joe Frazier. In 1967, Muhammad Ali was illegally stripped of his title and he was blackballed from boxing. His passport was taken away. and he was convicted of a crime that was later overturned by the Supreme Court in being a draft dodger. Muhammad Ali refused to serve in the Vietnam War. He refused to step forward when his name was called out at the Houston draft induction ceremony for Marines and U.S. Army military men. And immediately, as soon as he refused to serve, every sanctioning body stripped him of the title, and every state athletic commission stripped him of his license, and the government took away his passport. So for 3.5 years, Muhammad Ali could not make a living boxing. Finally, he came back in the fall of 1970 and won two fights. October 29th, 1970 versus Jerry Quarry. I covered that fight in the Life and Times of Muhammad Ali. His December 1970th 15th round knockout of Oscar Bonavena. And now his March 8th, 1971 fight against Joe Frazier. One of the greatest fights in boxing history. It's number 3 on my all-time list of greatest fights in boxing history. Joe Frazier won a decision in a phenomenal fight. But Joe Frazier fought the fight of his life in winning the fight. After the fight, Muhammad Ali proclaimed himself the people's champ. And for over three and a half years, again, Constantine, 3.5 years. Ali was forced out of boxing for 3.5 years after losing to Joe Frazier. He didn't get another world title shot at the heavyweight championship for 3.5 years. Until finally, he beat George Foreman October 30th, 1974 in Zaire, Africa to become a two-time heavyweight champion of the world in one of the greatest comebacks in boxing history. For those 3.5 years, Ali called himself the people's champ, the people's champion. Now, as far as Rocky's story about Ali, let me make sure I get this right, because the Hall of Fame happened last week, and Muhammad Ali's widow, Lonnie Ali, presented Rocky with the People's Champ title belt. And in the speech, Rocky said that he got permission from Muhammad Ali to use the People's Champ. Half pint? I don't know. I know that there was a card in 1998 at the Louisville Gardens in which Ali's family was there. Muhammad Ali wasn't there, but his family was there, and there could have been a meeting. I don't know the validity of that claim. From what I know about Muhammad Ali's widow, Lonnie Ali, she's an honest, moral person. She's of Muslim faith. She is a practicing Muslim, and one thing that practicing Muslims do is that they are very honest people. It is against their religion to lie. And I don't think that she would willfully lie. Now, the title belt, she didn't make. The WWE made that belt, but it could have been when they told her that they were going to induct her husband, and, you know, Muhammad Ali died back in 2016, June of 2016. Lonnie was like, no problem. I mean, yes, I will induct my husband into the WWE Hall of Fame. And they probably discussed with her about having The Rock involved, and she probably went ahead, and she brought up the story about The Rock asking Ali permission for the People's Champ. Look, half pint, it could be true. Rocky Maivia, Dwayne Johnson, his real name, idolized Muhammad Ali. You see a lot of Ali in Dwayne The Rock Johnson. his aura, the way when he steps in a room, when Muhammad Ali stepped into a room, all eyes were on Ali. Ali was always the biggest and baddest person in any room, the most famous person on the planet at one time. When The Rock goes in a room, all eyes are on The Rock. The Rock has a Muhammad Ali type aura. You watch the Hall of Fame, a room full of stars, and The Rock overshadowed all the stars that were in that room, whether it was CM Punk or John Cena or Undertaker. When The Rock stepped in with that magnificent white suit he had on, all eyes were on The Rock. And he walked out twice, and both times he walked up, once to induct his mother, the other to get the belt from Lonnie Ali. It was like a rock star times a million. You have never seen a wrestler with the aura The Rock has. The Rock is the Muhammad Ali of professional wrestling. And as far as his promos go, you saw a lot of Ali in The Rock's promos. Braggadocious, you know, making fun of people. That was what Ali did. And The Rock continued in that tradition. So I can't answer yes or no, half pint. I don't think The Rock is making a Hulk Hogan type lie. I believe there's some truth, and how much truth is there? Only Lonnie Ali, Ali's family, and The Rock knows. All right, great question as always, half pint. Now, next question is from, get this right, Colonel Gales. He asks, is it me or does it seem like the British fighters are more dedicated to boxing than the USA fighters today? Nah, in a way they are. They're more active. Anthony Joshua is very active. A lot of the very good British, even Joe Joyce, who's gotten beaten and battered twice last year, has been more active. Deontay Wilder's fought one time in 2 years and two times in 4 years. Okay. Big Baby Anderson, who fought tonight. This was the first time he fought since August. He's still developing. He needs to fight much more often and against better opposition. And that's just the heavyweights. British boxers, I give Matchroom / Eddie Hearn and Frank Warren, I give these promoters credit. They keep their fighters busy. Something that even the best American fighters in the United States are having an issue. Terrence Crawford is arguably the best fighter in the world. I got him number two after Inoue. He hasn't fought since he decimated Errol Spence on July 29th of last year. When Terrence Crawford finally steps in the ring, it's going to be over a year since he was in the ring. And at his age, that's not good. Great question, Colonel Gales. British fighters are much more active and they're taking their careers much more seriously than American fighters right now. All right. Now, revisit a question that Jesus Silas asked a few weeks ago. I gave you last week my top five Latina female actresses of all time. Now I'm going to give you my top five Latino men actresses of all time. Now, I'm going to do this off the top of my head, okay? Because I didn't do any research for this. So this is going to be right off the top of the OG Rob Silver's head, okay? There was a movie called Traffic many, many years ago. 2000, I believe, yeah. 24 years ago. And you have two of my top five Latin actors of all time in this movie. Benicio del Toro and Luis Guzman, both Puerto Rican. Both kill every role they did. And in Traffic, both Benicio del Toro and the great Luis Guzman killed their roles. Benicio del Toro won an Oscar. And of course, Luis Guzman, my brother from another mother, my twin brother from another mother, has been in so many great role movies and with so many memorable roles. Traffic, Pechanga in Carlito's Way. The list is endless of the monumental and famous roles Luis Guzman's made. Matter of fact, recently, the movie that was filmed in my old neighborhood in the Bronx, Story Avenue, he was phenomenal in that movie. And for those who haven't seen it, I highly recommend you guys go watch it. It's on Stars right now. Story Avenue, starring Luis Guzman. Great movie. He plays an MTA worker, a New York City Transit MTA worker. I would highly recommend you guys see that movie. So that's two of my top five. Raul Julia, gotta put him in my top five. Everybody remembers him from The Addams Family, but he's got a great filmography. Great actor, Raul Julia. I mean, tremendous actor. My father loved Raul Julia. Thought Raul Julia was a gem. And the sad thing is, Raul Julia, another great Puerto Rican actor, was 2 years younger than I will be in a few weeks. In 3 weeks, I'll be 56. Raul Julia died at the tender age of 54, when he should have been in his prime when it came to acting. It's unreal. And yeah, he was great in the Addams Family. And it's sad that he died a year after he had another hit movie with the Addams Family and the Addams Family Values. Sad. He was finally getting his just due as far as monetary roles go with the Addams Family series, and he dies. Sad. He was great in Tequila Sunrise with the legendary Mel Gibson and, of course, Kurt Russell and Michelle Pfeiffer. All right. So I've got three so far. You guys out there, you're gonna be like, why is there a Puerto Rican bias? Well, I'm gonna give you a non-Puerto Rican actor, the legendary salsa musician Ruben Blades, a favorite of Jesus and mine. Tremendous actor, tremendous actor, does not get the just due he deserves. Ruben Blades, the Panamanian god. He was born the same year as my father, 1948. So he'll be 76 in a few months. My father loved Ruben Blades. He used to laugh whenever Ruben Blades would be in a comedy, like the movie The Super. If you have not seen the movie The Super, I'd highly recommend it. Him and Joe Pesci had tremendous chemistry in that movie. I want to look up some of Ruben Blades' movies, because he's been in some great movies that you guys, I want you to check out his performances in More Better Blues. The Super, of course. He was great in The Super. Loved him in The Super. Loved him in The Super. The Devil's Own. Once Upon a Time in Mexico. And then The Josephine Baker Story. He was great in that movie. He was great. He was nominated for an Emmy for his performance in that movie. A tremendous actor. And in my top five. So right now I got four. And I'm not saying who's number one amongst these guys. I'm just giving you five legendary actors. And I'm going to round out my five with Antonio Banderas. Great actor. Whether it was Philadelphia, whether it was the many movies he did with Salma Hayek. Phenomenal chemistry between the two of them, by the way. Once Upon a Time in Mexico, you name it. They, Antonio Banderas, and of course, who he played, Puss in Boots. He did the voice for that cartoon. Tremendous actor, Antonio Banderas. Definitely in my top five. Oh, and the Mambo Kings, right? Antonio Banderas? Let me make sure I'm correct. I believe Antonio Banderas was in the Mambo Kings. Another underrated movie by a great actor from Spain. Let me make sure that it was Antonio Banderas in the Mambo Kings. I was right. My memory did not fail me. Played to the Bone was another great movie he was in. Of course, Puss in Boots. He's been in a lot of great movies. Great movies. Independent film, Dick S. Thieves. I would highly recommend you guys see that movie. And of course, The Legend of Zorro. Antonio Banderas. Antonio Banderas. Luis Guzman. Ruben Blades. Benicio del Toro. And Raul Julia are my five greatest Latin actors of all time. And that, ladies and gentlemen, ends the Q&A portion of the podcast. And now we go on to my historical overview of the recently departed Orrental James Simpson. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I've said many a times on this podcast and my Legends of Sports and Music podcast, that's available on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, that I don't recognize men that abuse women. And OJ did, whether he killed her or not, was, there is irrefutable proof. You cannot not, you cannot deny that he abused his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. Okay. That being said, I have to give him his just due today as far as his career and his life before Nicole Brown Simpson, because before there was a Nicole Brown Simpson, there was a man from San Francisco, California, who grew up in the projects, who was not the greatest high school student, was forced to attend junior college before becoming one of the greatest college running backs of all time, and then becoming one of the greatest running backs in football history. And just like Jim Brown, I gave Jim Brown a historical overview on my former podcast I used to do on the Fight Game Media, the Pound for Pound podcast. So I have to give O.J. Simpson the same respect. So here we go. And ladies and gentlemen, this historical overview is only going to go up to 1979. We're not going to talk about the domestic violence issues with him and his second wife, Nicole Simpson, Nicole Brown Simpson. We're not going to talk about the murder on this podcast. The alleged murder, the trial, all of that. I'm going to do a separate podcast on the trial because I was a grown man when the murder happened. I was 26 years old when Nicole Brown Simpson was murdered. I remember vividly the car chase day because I went to Great Adventure that day. And when I came home, I was expecting to see the NBA Finals game between the Knicks and the Rockets. And when I get home, I see that it's been taken off the air because they're watching the car chase. So I'll talk all about that in approximately 6 weeks when we cover the 30th anniversary of the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson. And that'll be a part two of O.J. Simpson's life and times. Right now, We're going to focus on his early life up until his retirement from the NFL. O.J. Simpson grew up in, let me make sure I get the correct name of these projects because it's hard to say. O.J. Simpson grew up in the Potrero Hill housing projects in San Francisco. O.J., same age as my father, same age as my mother. O.J. was born in July of 1947, so he would have been growing up in those projects in the 1950s to mid-60s, right? So he would have seen the same type of urban despair in San Francisco that my parents saw growing up in Spanish Harlem. All right, and just like in Spanish Harlem, O.J. had to battle, in San Francisco, O.J. had to battle gang activity and certain elements that tried to discourage him from fulfilling his dream of being a football player. He didn't have the grades to go to a major college out of high school, so he went to the city of San Francisco Community College, where he played football for 2 years. So finally, after getting his associate's degree, he was able to get a full scholarship to USC, and he made John McKay an instant coaching superstar for his play with USC, which wound up garnering him the Heisman Trophy in 1968. Now, while at the city of San Francisco Community College, he met the first love of his life, Marguerite Whitley. And you see the cover art for the podcast is an Ebony magazine cover with OJ and Marguerite. She was a beautiful woman. Striking beauty. And by the way, she has never claimed that OJ hit her. She has never stated that O.J. physically abused her. There is no proof that he ever abused Marguerite. I'll talk about why they got divorced in a minute, but it had nothing to do with domestic violence. Anyway, a year after they got married, their oldest child, O.J.'s oldest child, Marguerite's oldest child, Nicole said, and by the way, Marguerite was 19, O.J. Simpson was 19 when they got married. Oh, it was a month before O.J.'s 20th birthday, and Marguerite was 19. So the Simpsons, O.J. and Marguerite, similar to my parents, were married when they were teenagers. My parents got married at 18. The Simpsons, O.J. and his first wife, Marguerite, were married at 19. And back then, people got married younger. They got married at a very young age. People were marrying their childhood sweethearts. Or in O.J. and Marguerite's case, their college sweethearts. 1968, they have Arnell Simpson, the very beautiful Arnell Simpson, O.J.'s oldest daughter. And the similarities between the Simpsons and my parents are kind of eerie here because my parents were 18 when they got married in 1966. The Simpsons were 19 when they got married in 1967. I was born in 1968, and the oldest of my parents' kids, and Arnell Simpson was born in 1968, the oldest of O.J. and Marguerite's kids. 1970, Jason Simpson, O.J.'s oldest son, is born. During this time period, O.J. Simpson, after winning the Heisman Trophy, is drafted by the Buffalo Bills. Now we're going to talk about his pro football career. And O.J. Simpson did not start off as what people might think of as an instant star, even though he was the first pick in the 1969 NFL draft by the Buffalo Bills. He was the first pick. First 3 years of his career were horrible. He got off to a bad start. His rookie year, he only rushed for 697 yards. His second year, his sophomore year, 488 yards. His third year, 742 yards. Now, we'll go on my father's memory, because back when I first started watching sports in 1977, my father always talked about how the two greatest running backs he ever saw as we were watching football were O.J. Simpson 2 and Jim Brown number 1. And during the 1977 season, I got to see O.J. Simpson in his prime for the only time. I would see him play three times in 3 years, 77, 78, 79. But in 1977, that was the only year that I got to see O.J., the real O.J. But while talking about O.J. in 1977, my father told me that when he first came into the NFL, the Buffalo Bills did not use him properly. They had him sharing the ball with a guy not on his level. But finally, in 1972, they took the shackles off O.J. And from 1972 to 1976, O.J. had one spectacular season after another. In 1973, his NFL MVP season, he was the first NFL player to rush for over 2,000 yards. He rushed for 2,003 to be exact. And he did it in 14 games. Everybody else that's rushed for 2,000 yards, Eric Dickerson, all the other cats, they had to do it in 16 games. O.J. did it in 14 games. He didn't need any extra games. Back then, it was only 14 games in the season. And that year, the year he rushed for 2,000 yards, he averaged 6 yards per carry. That's unheard of in the NFL. Unheard of. You know who rushes for 6 yards or more? Running quarterbacks like a Michael Vick in his prime. Lamar Jackson today, they'll rush for over 6, 7, 8 yards per carry because they got the ball and they can take off. Running back from going into the line, having to break tackles, having to make you miss. 6 yards per carry, ladies and gentlemen. In 1975, he rushed for 1,800 yards, averaging 5.5 yards per carry. In 1976, the last full year in his prime, 1,500 yards, 5.2 yards a carry. Those are numbers that Barry Sanders used to put up in the 90s for the Detroit Lions. In the 1970s, the best American boxer in the world, well, not in the world, the best American boxer was Muhammad Ali. The best fighter of the 1970s was Berto Duran. We want to take everything back to boxing. The best basketball player of the 1970s was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. As far as the best baseball player of the 1970s, you could make an argument for Pete Rose. You could make an argument for Joe Morgan. There were so many great baseball players in the 1970s. You didn't have a definitive number one. But in basketball, it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. In football, it was Orental James Simpson. He was the best football player throughout the 1970s. The numbers don't lie. I don't want to talk about championships. You can't talk about championships because O.J. Simpson was a one-man offense. Yeah, Terry Bradshaw won 4 Super Bowls. He had Franco Harris. He had Swan and Stallworth. They had Terry Bradshaw. You can't say any of those guys were the best offensive player, the best player, the best NFL player of the decade. The best NFL player of the 1970s was O.J. Simpson, period, end of story. And in the 1970s, like my father used to always say, the three most famous athletes in the 1970s were Muhammad Ali, in the world, were Muhammad Ali, Pelé, and O.J. Simpson. I got to see O.J. Simpson play in his prime. 1977, O.J. was only 30 years old when that season started. I got to see him play in 1977 against the New York Jets. And I want to talk about this game because he was phenomenal in this game. And my father was schooling me throughout that game, telling me about O.J. at college, telling me about the 2,000-yard season O.J. had in 73. And as a kid, before I became a sports fan at the age of 8 in 1977, I used to see O.J. commercial after commercial, Hertz commercial. I saw him in the movie The Towering Inferno. O.J. was a larger-than-life man, entertainer, athlete in my childhood, like a Muhammad Ali, like a Pele. You heard them all the time. Well, the first time I got to see O.J., and it's the only time I got to see O.J. in his prime at the age of 30, was October 9th, 1977, a game that was shown on WNBC Channel 4. And in that game, the Jets won 24-19. O.J. rushed for 122 yards on only 23 carries. I mean, he was making the Jets miss. He was breaking tackles. I was like, man. So that's why they call him the Juice. He single-handedly beat the Falcons the following week, 3-0, rushing for 138 yards. But on October 30th, 1977, in a game against the Seattle Seahawks, first half, he rushed for 32 yards on 9 carries. He hurt his knee. And when he didn't play in the second half, they didn't need him. They were getting destroyed. They lost 56-17, so it didn't make sense for them to put O.J. back on the field. But his knee hurt so bad after the game that he had to have arthroscopic knee surgery. His season ended. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in 7 games, he had rushed for 557 yards. So he would have had another 1,000-yard season. That was the year Walter Payton broke O.J. Simpson's single-game record of 273 yards by rushing for 275 yards. That year, Walter Payton supplanted O.J. Simpson as the best running back in football, and Walter Payton later on would become, in my father's opinion, the second greatest running back of all time that he ever saw, surpassing O.J., and only Jim Brown was greater than Walter Payton in my father's eyes. In my eyes, Walter Payton is still the greatest running back I ever saw, Barry Sanders being number 2. O.J. was never the same after that knee injury. He was a free agent after the season ended, and he signed with the San Francisco 49ers. So he got to play in his hometown for the last 2 years of his career. But wow, it's funny. His professional life and his personal life flourished at the same time. From afar, it looked like him and Marguerite had the perfect marriage. They had the 2 kids early, and then in 1977, they had baby Aaron was born. Aaron Simpson, another baby girl. But during the time that Marguerite was pregnant with Aaron Simpson, O.J. met Nicole Brown. And at that point in time, Nicole Brown was 18 in 1977, I believe. Let me make sure I get the ages correct here. Because another thing I do not like is men who date much younger women that are teenagers that they have no business being with. At the time that they met, she was 18 years old. She was 18 years old. And O.J. began an affair with her right after while his wife was pregnant with their third child. And finally, in 1979, I believe March of 1979, Marguerite divorced O.J. And in August of 1979, the baby Aaron that was born in September of 1977 during the midst of OJ's sordid affair with a teenage girl. OJ was 30 years old dating an 18-year-old girl. Come on, man. That's fucking disgrace. Anyway, I promised I would stick to the career, but that really pisses me the fuck off. I lost my train of thought because of the age difference there. Anyway, OJ and Marguerite were divorced in March of 1979. And right before OJ Simpson's final season as an NFL running back, their daughter Aaron died while drowning in the pool. The pool of the home that OJ used to live with Marguerite in, I believe, Beverly Hills, California. That was now Marguerite's home because OJ wasn't living there anymore. OJ moved out and he was shacking up with Nicole Brown. She hadn't married. Nicole Brown and OJ didn't get married until 1985. We'll discuss that in June when we do the 30th anniversary of the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson. OJ Simpson's daughter died right before the NFL season started in 1979. By the way, let me backtrack for a second. OJ, after OJ's knee injury, he became a free agent, and the San Francisco 49ers signed OJ to a 2-year contract. In 1978, OJ passed his prime now, 31 years old, that knee injury, and then back in the 1970s when you had arthroscopic knee surgery and you were a running back that relied on speed and strength, you were never the same. And OJ was never the same. In 1978, he only rushed for 593 yards on 3.7 yards per carry. In 1979, he rushed for 460 yards. Now, we're going to do a game log here, and we're going to see if and when OJ missed any time because his daughter died August 26, 1979. And look at this. September 9th, 1979 was the opening game of the season. They played the Dallas Cowboys. They lost 21-13. O.J. Simpson's daughter died exactly 2 weeks before the opening game of the season. Now, O.J. Simpson was on a horrible, horrible San Francisco 49ers team. That year, the 49ers record was, 2-14, if I'm not mistaken. If I'm wrong, you guys can correct me. They were the drizzling shits, right? They were the drizzling shits. A pathetic team. A pathetic team. And yet, OJ did not take any parental grieving time. His daughter died. Why is he playing right after his daughter died? Right after they buried his daughter, he was playing football. It's not like they needed him. His daughter didn't get to see her second birthday. She was born in September of 77. She died in August of 79. I don't know the circumstances as to who was watching her when she drowned in the pool. But damn it, OJ should not have been playing football at all in the month of September. He should have taken the entire month of September off to be with his children who had lost their youngest child. I'm talking about Jason, who would have been 9 at the time, and Arnell, who would have been 11 at the time. Never mind his ex-wife Marguerite, they had gotten divorced in March of 79, so there was no need for him to be with her because that relationship was broken because of his infidelity. But he had two children that needed him. Instead, he's out there playing football, going on the road. Okay, let me get off my soapbox. Anyway, 1979, O.J. Simpson finally has his final season, only rushed for 460 yards. He announces retirement. 5 years later, he's inducted, first ballot in the Hall of Fame. In 1983, he made the College Football Hall of Fame. 1985, he made the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And up until that point, he was considered by many no worse than the third greatest running back that ever lived after Jim Brown and Walter Payton, because Walter Payton has surpassed both Jim Brown and O.J. Simpson in career rushing yards. Ladies and gentlemen, that right there is my historical overview of O.J. Simpson's personal life, career, from when he was a child until his retirement in 1979. I'm not going to go into any further details. God bless Aaron Simpson for her. She only lived to be 23 months old. What a huge tragedy. As a man who lost his son, it's me, I lost my only child when he was 29. There's no bigger tragedy than losing a child. I know people out there listening to this podcast are going to say, well, OJ probably felt the only way to deal with the death of his daughter was to play football. You know what? If that's the case, so be it. One thing I want to suggest out there is the turning point of OJ Simpson's life could have easily been the death of his daughter. Because before Aaron died, my father would tell me years later in the 90s when the controversy with the murder occurred. Up until that point, there were never any rumors about OJ partying with cocaine and alcohol. That didn't happen until after he left Marguerite, after he began dealing with Nicole Brown Simpson, and after baby Aaron died. I think that death had a very negative and psychological impact on the rest of O.J. Simpson's life. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back next week to review the Devin Haney-Ryan Garcia fight. Also, during the middle of this week, Wednesday or Thursday, I will put out part 6 of my Life and Times of Sugar Ray Leonard, a historical overview tribute podcast. We will take a look at his November 25th, 1980 fight at the New Orleans Superdome, the rematch versus Roberto Duran, one of the most controversial fights in boxing history. I'm going to end the podcast with Howard Cosell talking about the career of O.J. Simpson, and we will also do a synopsis of, I will play a synopsis of O.J.'s, I believe, 2,000-yard season. So you'll be hearing that after I sign off here on the Hitman Chronicles. Until next time, when we talk Sugar Ray Leonard versus Roberto Duran, the rematch, enjoy these clips of O.J. Simpson about to play. And remember, everybody, please, life is short. Be blessed and be a blessing.
Gabe, still another Heisman Trophy winner. O.J. Simpson of USC had to be the runner of the decade. With the Buffalo Bills, he did something that no other man has ever done in the history of pro football. He gained more than 2,000 yards in a single season. And O.J., wise man that he is, will remember it.
I think my number one highlight was probably 73 to 2,000 yards. Right before the game ended, I was in the locker room all by myself, and I had an almost metaphoric feeling in there, you know, that I had finally made it after those first few rough years in Buffalo, and I realized then that no matter what I did, or no matter what records I had, they'll all be broken one day, that I will always be remembered for being the first guy to go over 2,000 yards.
Been supreme for the last 2 years, but let's take a look at the man who played his last game yesterday and who was clearly the greatest performer of the decade. Number 32, the Jew's O.J. Simpson. ABC Sports first began to follow the Juice on NCAA college football in his extraordinary career at USC. This touchdown burst against UCLA, so typical, and the Juice won the Heisman Trophy. Even in postseason competition, in a game that really didn't matter, the competitor showed itself in Simpson, like right there in the Hula Bowl game. In a downpour, the Juice, fumbling a kickoff, picked it up and rambled all the way. 1973 was to be his greatest professional football year. He began it against the Patriots with a scintillating dash like this one. And, of course, who can forget the way 1973 ended in the snows of Shea Stadium. This was the game where the Juice did something no other running back had ever done before in the pro ranks. He went above the 2,000-yard mark for rushing in a single season, and he did it with that run. This is the way it ended yesterday. The Juice going out on top. Maybe his team wasn't, but the Juice was. And throughout his extraordinary career, his personality, his character shone through, his buoyancy. And so, au revoir, O.J.